Chaim, did you hear Monday's shiur? I responded to your smirk. You didn't hear the shiur. Rabbi Shlomo, who am I teaching?
Oh.
What?
The date.
Yeah, I have to say the date. It's Sunday, October 14th, 2018, and I say hello to all my great students sitting in front of me and all the great sub-students around the world. And we're talking about Klausner and Agnon and how they hated each other. And when Klausner died, they named the street Rehov Klausner. And Agnon was all upset because now he's living on Klausner Street. So his friends made him feel better by asking, quote, they said this Agnon, would you have preferred that you be dead and Klausner would have to live on Agnon Street? And Agnon answered, no, it's better this way. Now this I heard from my grandson. The big shul in the neighborhood is the Agnon Beit Knesset. Recently, a group broke away and they started a Shevioni egalitarian minyan, which is pure apikarsis in my opinion. And they call it the Klausner minyan, which I guess is at least somewhat appropriate. Okay, now down to work. Yitzchak, I want to talk to you after Shia. I had a brainstorm.
Rehov Agnon.
Baruch Hashem, we have a Rehov Agnon today, a Rehov Klausner.
My wife's mother founded the neighborhood.
Your wife's brother.
My wife's
uncle, not your brother. I know her brother. Her uncle founded the neighborhood.
There's a street called Cosby Street.
That's your family. He was the head of police or the head
of a cousin.
That was a cousin. You have big yichis, Yitzchak. With all that yichis and the 2.5 shekels, you can get on a bus. Okay, Baruch Hashem. It's a very fascinating shiur today. We continue, and I'm opening up a new world. I'm going to quote something that no one else in the world has quoted until this moment. Why am I so sure? It's very simple, Chaim. It just appeared in print, so I'm pretty sure no one else has quoted it yet. What are we talking about? We're talking about the question that Rav Menashe Klein received many, many years ago, but it represents America, represents the 20th century. If you're allowed to interrupt, to give the people the pages by which to daven. And you saw that Rav Menashe Klein was totally negative compared to when the way I ended off last week's class. Rav Moshe Feinstein, totally positive. So much so that Rav Menashe Klein even invalidates. Imagine if he tells the rabbi, maybe you should daven it home and then come and announce the pages. But he says, then people will think the rabbi doesn't daven. So even to flip the pages, with the professional scoreboard, it's very simple. Even that, Reb Menashe Klein was opposed. And he won't give reasons. Moshe, he says, and I mentioned in class in passing, not all of you understood what I was referring to. A kid came to my class Monday, and he told me afterwards, his mind is shaking from all the information he heard. So I told my wife, you know, sometimes I probably go too fast, because I take for granted everyone knows my references. But just to slow down a second, Moshe, what kind of matzah do you eat in Pesach? Hand or machine?
First night we eat hand matzah.
All right. You already fell into the trap. Tell me, did the Rav eat hand matzah? Did the Rabban Soloveitchik eat hand matzah? Right, no, but they didn't eat hand matzah on principle because the machine matzah is infinitely more kosher. Anyone who saw it with your own eyes, you know what I'm talking about. Cleaning hand matzah when humans are throwing it around, and l'shem matzah mitzvah midruf toizol min al zogin l'shem mitzvah. I baked hand matzah. But believe me, I only eat machine batza. There are reasons why. The only shayla is the lishma. That's the problem. You understand that thing? The lishma. When you bake hand matzah, you're a human being. But when you turn on the machine, is that a lishma? So they paskin yes, because the human being is turning it on. All right. Tell me, are there Jews that won't go near machine matzah? Treif, puzzle. You study the Divrei Chaim, Reb Chaim Halberstam, the sons of Rav? Oh, have you done a master's thesis on this topic? Well, you can do it if you want to amass this topic. I'm throwing out to you the controversy of a machine matzah. It could be Hillel. It could be, I'm already saying Hillel. It could be Chaim, that it's a doctorate, more than just the master's. All right, so one of the biggest opponents, I'm being very makatsan, I spoke about this years ago in great detail, but one of the greatest opponents, Binyamin, was Reb Chaim Sansa. Why did he oppose it? It says, Atam Kamusim Madi. Won't give the reason. Until today, I can give you this reason, you'll find that reason. We're all guessing in the dark. The same thing, he was opposed. The real reason may be that, how do you change Yiddishkeit? For Dore Dora, people were baking matzah. This is the way they baked. The Kollel goes to bake matzah. You'll see this year, Rav David Miller takes everyone to bake matzah. Our dear Sherry, I know Pesach is coming because she doesn't take the hand matzahs home. She leaves it in her office high up where no one can touch it. So when I see that, I know Pesach is around the corner. Home is not Pesach. Like, I have a place I can take Pesach stuff from. I don't have little kids anymore. I have a place way up. I put it, no one can touch it. But that's probably the real reason. The many other reasons, it's not the only reason. Why is Reb Menashe Klein opposed? And I come to the same conclusion, and I'll strengthen it, if not this week, next week, in a different context. We're changing Torah, we're changing minhag, we're changing minhag avoteinu. Why do chassidim wear shtreimels? Can anyone tell me what one rav, I just saw a quote on a Haredi website, he said, I get a good salary for being a rabbi in Israel. You know why I get the salary? Because I have to suffer with a shtreimel during the summer. Well, he's a rav. If he won't wear a shtreimel, people will laugh at him. What kind of rabbi are you? Chassidic the rav. So he wears a kripani shalalim. Everyone walks around with a black suit during the summer. I'm wearing black pants today. If my wife sees me put on black pants during the summer, I have to stand in the corner with a dunce cap. Black attracts heat. You have to wear a lighter color during the summer. But a rav nebuch dafgein mit bigdei kahuna. So that's why you get your salary. You're sweating, you're suffering. But you don't want to change the deportment, the dress, the way a rav looked. At least, I don't want to be stupid enough to say from time immemorial. I don't know what Rabbanim looked like, or maybe I do know. But it certainly is not the way we look today. If I met Rashi, or I met Rabbeinu Tam, if I met the Rashba, the Ritba, they would be dressed differently than the Rabbanim of today. But at least, I say, haben der Rabbanim gegangen in the alte Heim, this is the way the rabbis went in the old Heim. East Europe, and now the Sfadim, many of them fell for the ploy, and they dress like Ashkenazic Rabbanim. All right, so he's opposed. Rav Meisher, on the other hand, is totally, totally open, and he gives the Eitzel at the rabbi daven at home, and he says, a better Eitzel, let the kid flip the pages. All right. Now this tshuva was written, and here's where I have to show the power of the internet. If anyone maledicts the internet, I will be upset. There's bad things on the internet, absolutely, but there are bad things all over the place. You get into a car and drive, God have mercy, what you may or may not face when you're driving. Ubachata b'chayim. Life is about choice. So this tshuva was to Rabbi Gertzulin, who was the mashkiach at Torah Vadas. The tshuva was undated, and it was very important for me to try to find the date, because I claim that this tshuva represents Reb Menashe Klein when he's first getting started in the United States. It's Chelik Bet of his 18 volumes of tshuvat. He didn't know America yet. It's also fascinating that Torah Vadas turned to him, and as I explained to you, Torah Vadas at that time, come closer, don't sit with here, right? Torah Vadas at that time had endless Rabbanim out in the field. It's not like today that you think of the field and all you think of why you Rabbanim. So who is this Rabbi Gertzulin? Who was he? So I mentioned it on the internet, and do you believe it or not, I got a response. His own grandson, who's a first-rate Talmud Chacham, I've corresponded with him before, and I've seen his Sfarim, is my own Talmud. He's, to coin my new word, he's a sub-Talmud, Rabbi Moshe Leibowitz. And this now ties together the Sunday class with the Monday class. What did we speak about Monday? I mentioned when I was giving coming attractions, I said, I'm going to take on art scrolls. I noticed a few students smirked at each other. What the heck is that moron Rakefit going after art scroll? So let me make it clear. I love art scroll. I love their Gemara, and I love their Chumash, and I love their Nach, and I love their Mishnah. I love art. But when it comes to Jewish history books, when you're intellectually dishonest, I'm a Talmud of the Rav. I'm not the first one to say this. I always had the feeling with Moriah Rebbe, if you ate chazer on yom kippur, was not as bad as being intellectually dishonest. Why? It's very simple. Because chazer on yom kippur, you're doing a sin. When you want to do tshuva, you know you did a sin. And you'll do tshuva be'ezrat Hashem. But intellectual dishonesty is afadotenkeit in the ganze menschlichkeit. Go and translate that. Afad Jack, help me. Yitz, who speaks Yiddish from the house? Yitz, your parents spoke Yiddish to you. Afadotenkeit in the ganze personality. How would you translate
fadotenkeit?
Corrupt, the rottenness, the schmeck, that's not good. When you're intellectually dishonest, that's all your life you're going to be like that. You understand? This is a tremendous problem. To be so, I showed.
Who determines
what?
That you're intellectually.
When you I mentioned two books on Monday. I mentioned the book on I mentioned the book on Mr. Mendelovich, and I mentioned the book on Rabbi Phil Hirsch. They do not mention the man who built Torah in America, Rabbi Dr. Dov Revel Zeicher Tzadik Livracha. So I made the point that's done al Pishita, and a moron named Rakefit wrote to them. I got an answer like Meod Sidon is sitting in front of me and taking notes on Shas and Paiskim. Hold on.
Rabbi Pliskin put out a book on happiness, whatever it was, and when he lists the great men, the great rabbis, guess who's missing?
Who's
there?
No, all right, that's what we're talking about. That's intellectual dishonesty. Anyway, not for now. But I mentioned last week Torah Vidas, remember the lecture? We mentioned for the first time 1940 Reb Shlomo Hyman. How did Reb Shlomo Hyman get to America? Because of Rabbi Revel. Rabbi Revel, the Meishita, Reb Shlomo Hyman. Chaim, did you ever hear the name of Shlomo Hyman? Did you know he was a giant of Torah? The tragedy is he died very young. He died in his mid-40s. He was Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas. You'll hear the whole connection. It's in last Monday's Shia. That's not important now. What is important, who is Reb Shlomo Hyman's top Talmud? Rav Gertzulin. And he was such a top Talmud that he was appointed the Mashgiach of Torah Vadas even before he was married. So now it all ties together. Rav Shlomo Hyman was the Rebbe of Rav Gertzulin. He only trusted his shrita. Rav Gertzulin was evidently a shochet, in addition to being mashgiach and Torah Vadas. He was very close to my grandfather, his Talmud. He was appointed mashgiach before he was married, and was a huge matmid. Now, I want to thank my sub-Talmud, Rabbi Moshe Leibowitz, and by the way, you all eat from his hashgacha too, not only his grandfather, he's one of the top rabbanim in the Chaf Kei. So those of you that are samach on the Chaf Kei Heksha, you should know that having a role in it is Rabbi Moshe Leibowitz, Chaf Kei Kashrut Organization, the actual name. Now, he sent me a bit of a biography that Torah Vadas puts out on Rav Hyman, on Rav Shlomo Hyman. And here's a story that I remember well. Mashkin is kachat. I thank Rabbi Leibowitz. But this story made the rounds when I came into YU 51. They were still talking about the story. As I said to you, in that time, the relationship between all the yeshiva, there wasn't the chasm, there wasn't the break, there wasn't the fission that we have today. And this story is very, very moving, that Rav Nosson Eliyahu Gertzulin, that's his grandfather, was with Reb Shlomo Hyman when he passed away. right before his patir, and I remember this was Maskin Ishkachat, I heard this in YU, I heard this in Lakewood afterwards, the Torah V'das Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Hyman said, prepare two chairs. My Rebbe, Reb Chaim Meisa Grishensky, and Reb Akiva Eger. They have come to accompany me to the next world. And you'll ask, why Reb Akiva Eger? Because they used to tell me that Reb Shlomo Hyman in the Shehurim, the heart of what he was doing was so fa'enferring a kusha from Reb Akiva Eger to fa'enfer. Again, my English is disappearing. To answer, to explain, to make it clear when Reb Akiva Eger, I understand English, but we can read from Reb Akiva Eger and Reb Shlomo Hyman in a kusha in a goyish sprach, in a Gentile language. So to fa'enfer, to so fa'enferin, he was very great, Rebbe Akiva Eger, and that's who we saw coming to accompany him to the next world. So I want to thank Rabbi Lavovitz. We solved the problem of who the Rabbi Ritzelman was, and it all fits into what we've said. Now, a sideshow from this tshuva that affects each and every one of us, from Yehuda to Binyamin, halacha l'maasa. What's the heart of what, I come back to a source I quoted Michael weeks ago, Shabbos, Avdalin Omer Aleph, the whole question, Hidbik Pat B'Tanur, Hitirolo de Doto, Kodim Shom Le Deitiu Chalichachatat. The Gemara, without going in now, because the Gemara, it's really not clear what's it talking about, Pein HaShmash, Shabbos, what's the Yisim Malacha, but the simple pshat, some dummy threw bread into the oven, dough into the oven, and it's on the wall, and within a half hour it's going to be a total bread baked on Shabbos. He did an Issa D'Oraita, whether it's B'Shogeg or Mezid, depends, but he can even say, Thief Skila, God have mercy. And someone came along, and he said, what did you do? And he could remove the bread, which is forbidden, whatever the reason is, it's muktzer, it's half-baked, he could remove the bread, so he's going to do a little sin to save the other guy from a big sin. Yes, yes, Moshe.
The Gemara concludes that only the guy who put it in is allowed to remove the bread. Someone else is not allowed to do it.
But the havi amin of the Gemara is that an outsider can remove, do an Issa, a smaller Issa, to save a big Issa. And the Gemara, again, Tosfos has a shitat, and it opens up a world of learning. But halacha l'maisa, the Gemara says to you black and white, you are not allowed to do a minor sin to save a Jew from a more major sin. And this is the halacha, and we saw that last week with the Noda B'Yehuda, making a minyan later in the day after Zman Kriyat Shema, because the old people can't get to minyan early. And they know this, absolutely not. Since when can you do a sin and not say Kriyat Shema Bizman, or even if you say it Bizman, but to say it without Bichoter, the way the Anshei Knesset Gedola were metaken it, absolutely not. And we saw, we ended off the class with the Pre-Yitzchak, the Pre-Yitzchak Plaza. We tied it in with YU, Reb Moshe Shatzkis. Have to tell you, I don't know how many of you can appreciate it, but Reb Moshe Shatzkis left a beautiful family. He, his brother, children in YU today, children in Lakewood. It's a family, you meet many members of the family. And to me, whenever I meet a Blaza, I always, to me, it's like living history. A nainikel from Reb Moshe Shatzkis, who was raised by Reb Yitzchak Blaza, who is one of the Talmidim Mufhakim of Reb Yisrael Salanta. To me, it's living history. You're grasping at continuity. And he had the Shiloh in St. Petersburg, Leningrad afterwards, the White Knights. White Knights, Zman Kriyat Shema is 2:30 in the morning. No? Can you make a minyan? If you don't make a minyan then, you're never going to have a minyan of people. What's better, wait until 8 o'clock, say Kriyat Shema without Birchat Torah, wait for the minyan, or to daven be yechidr at 3 o'clock in the morning, but daven properly. And he also paskins, daven properly, don't wait for the minyan. All right, this is open to question. Halacha l'maisa today, most of us are noheg to daven with the minyan, say kriyat shma, it's a b'dieved, without b'chater, but afterwards in davening we'll say kriyat shma b'b'chater. Now I want to show you a source that I don't believe has ever been quoted before. And again, this problem comes to the fore. You recognize this is the latest issue of Ma'ayan. It just came out a week ago or so. Ma'ayan, I've, maybe you're not familiar with it. Ma'ayan is a very interesting publication. It represents Poli Agudat Yisrael. Do any of you recall what Poli Agudat Yisrael was? Poli Agudat Yisrael doesn't exist today, but there is a part of Israel on your way to Ashkelon, on your way to Ashdod. It's popularly called Pi-Land. Do you recognize that? Poli Agudat Yisrael, Pi-Land. Why is it called Pi-Land? There are many yeshivim, there are kibbutzim, there's Chafetz Chaim there, there's Yad Binyamin there, I think that began as a moshav. And it's a tremendous area. What's Poli Agudah? Poli Agudah was a cross between Mizrahi and Agudah. Beginning with the formation of the State of Israel in 48, 49, Mizrahi and Agudah were very close together. They ran a joint ticket in the first election. And people who were Agudistim felt ill at ease in denying the Medina. Medina is here. And Mashiach is not here yet, but we have to be positive, we have to contribute, and they couldn't become total Mizrachistim, but they were Poli Agudah. Ultimately, that disappeared. It disappeared for a very simple reason, because this was the generation that came here from Europe. Many of them were Germans, Torum Derech Eretz. If you know the history of Chafetz Chaim, the history of Lavi, the history of many of the kibbutzim, of the kibbutz adati, a lot of yekes were involved because they viewed Torah v'avodah as a continuation of Torah derech Eretz of Rav Hirsch. The next generation, the third generation, today you either go Agudah or you go Mizrahi. There's no need for something in between. You see, 70 years ago, and Agudist said, how can I go Mizrahi? The women don't cover their hair. Today, you go to the Yehuda V'Shomron, 99% of the women cover their hair, kedat v'kedin. You look at the length of the skirts of the girls who graduate the Ulpana, the skirts are longer than the Beis Yaakov girls. One of the Agudistim who broadened the little Zilbeschlag duty once said in public at an RCA convention here in Israel, and he spoke and he said that we've lived to see the Mizrahi is more frum than the Agudah. All right, that's not entirely true, but on a certain level there is truth to it. So you see, you want to be an Agudist, you can be a Mizrachist and be just as frum, or you wind up Rav Shach and produce the big split, but there's no room for something in the middle. You want to be in the middle, so you have the chadalim. You know what I'm talking about? Charedim, datiyim, lumiyim. In Yerushalayim, you have Rabbi Tal, the breakaway from Merkaz HaRav. A good deal of my brother's family, my nieces and nephews, I have endless relatives, followers of Rabbi Tal, Rabbi Steinberg, Rabbi Zuckerman, that entire yeshiva that broke away from Merkaz HaRav. All right, but Poli Agudah, Ma'ayan, was their publication. And where was it different? For instance, you'll take Hapades, the rabbinical journal in America. You'll take a rabbinical journal in Israel. Where was Mayan different? It was traditional Torah, but with flavoring. Sweets on top of it. Chocolate spread. Whatever you do. Sprinkles. Multicolored sprinkles of Chochmat Yisrael. You follow? It was an enhancement. There was a reflection yet of Torah V'derech Eretz of Rav Hirsch. Now, Ma'ayan today is published by Yeshivat Shalavim. Shalavim is the closest of all the yeshivat where there's an overtone of Torah V'derech Eretz of Rav Hirsch, of the Germans, etc. Mayan is their publication. They took it over. I knew the original editor, Rabbi Emanuel, was an optometrist, the center of town. If you ever wanted, I taught his daughters in Mechala in the 70s. If you ever wanted to see Torim Derech Eretz, he was a walking example of Torim Derech Eretz. All right, but life moves on. He's no longer here. And it's now edited by Rav Katan, who I had the privilege of teaching his mother. She was one of the most brilliant ladies you'll ever meet in your life, Shulamit Katan. She was the librarian of the Knesset, and her mind always saw Torah. All my Shayura and Mechala, she was not a sub-student, but a regular student, never missing a class. Now, in this issue, the latest issue, beginning on page 4 and 5, we have a tshuva from the greatest representative of Torim Derech Eretz in modern times, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Chaim, have you studied the writings of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg? What do you know about him? Are you aware that down the hall I can show you the classroom and I can show you with an 18-year-old kid sat in a class of a guy named Drakefit in 1981 or so, and the Rebbe mentioned the three-day Eish, and that was the first time in his life he ever heard of the three-day Eish, and he went on to do a brilliant doctorate at Harvard, the last doctorate done under Professor Tversky's guidance. And if you don't believe me, read the introduction where he says, I first heard about this radiation in the class of Rabbi Aaron Rakefet in Beit Medrash LaTorah, Baruch Hashem. He also put out two volumes of letters of this radiation. Now here is a tshuva that's being published for the first time. We have a big problem with this tshuva, which we suffer with in response to literature. We see the answer, we don't see the question. We don't know the exact details. But it's evidently written to a Yekka who knew Rav Weiss. Rav Weiss, to be very brief, again, I've spoken about him in great detail, but I was about Rav Weinberg. I've spoken about Rav Weinberg in great detail, thank you, Yitzchak, but that was about 20 years ago. To be very brief, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, he was a Litvak. He studied in Slabatka. He was brilliant. He was considered, if you studied in an Eastern European yeshiva 120 years ago, or if you read the memoir literature, heightened by, who helped me out, Reb Nissim Kamenetsky's volumes called Making of a Gadol, right? You will find that the greatest Eloi in the yeshiva world was Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. However, he had one problem. He listened to the Mashgiach, the Alt of Slabatka. The Alt of Slabatka, whom he revered, Reb Nathan Zvi Finkel, was very worried that he was too broad-minded. Why was he broad-minded? What happened with Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg? Nu Dov, you know the story? He was going to Slabatka, he was on the train, he didn't know how to speak Russian, and he had to get off the train and had to change for another train. And because he didn't know how to speak Russian, he didn't understand the directions, he missed the connecting train, and he had to sleep in the subway and the train station until there was another train one day later. He was so frustrated that he made up his mind he's going to learn Russian. When you start to learn Russian, tell me, the Rav's mother was Bekiah in Sefer Tehillim. She also was Bekiah in the great Russian novelist, War and Peace, Tolstoy, what goes on. There's no end to what she knew in Russian literature. So the Alt of Slabatka was a little bit worried, this fellow is growing too broad-minded. No, who can go further? In order to save him from leaving the yeshiva and worried stiff, because many great yeshiva students became maskil and became enlightened, became part of the great world, so they made a shidduch for him. A rav died, Pilwitzki, if I'm pronouncing it right, he died and he left the yatoma. And this was like Rabbi Teitz. If you know Rabbi Teitz's story, when he came to Elizabeth, Rabbi Prell had died, and they said the rabbi will go to the one who marries Rabbi Prell's daughter. And you, by the way, she was a great lady. He got a bargain. He got a fabulous wife, and he got the rabbinate of Elizabeth all in one. So they made a shidduch with Rabbi Weinberg with this girl. And the shidduch lo ala yafer. He was a great intellectual, a worldly person, a gonadin. And she evidently, I don't know, was a wonderful lady. People tell me never to criticize her. People who knew her told me he was a loner. It was part of his personality. He was a genius, a loner. You find this with geniuses. They can't relate to the normal world. Well, the Rav did relate. He was married, children. But one of the Rav's, continuity, he has someone who never married, a dear friend of mine, my classmate. So you see, you got to be able to relate. I put on a Boston Red Sox hat. I wore it Thursday, Friday. I can give you pictures of it. People, Yomo took the picture, sent it to a student. The student said, I have it in the office. I'll wear it later. You can see. I just answered, Yomo, I just answered Ellie. I know when I'm defeated. He doesn't believe it. He thought you made it up. I sent it on to others. So I'm having a good time with the hat. I walked into the Shtiblach. Jack can testify. People look the hat. What's going on? A Yankee, a gentleman. You got to know how to relate to the world. Not everyone can do it, particularly if you're a genius. I'm a dummy, but Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. So, and she remarried and had children. They're living in Israel. So it was more his fault. By the way, I heard this. Yeah. I heard this from his own Talmidim. He never remarried. I can quote names to who I heard this from. But Mamish heard it word by word what I just said. So, but it's not nice. You see, Steve Bressler, just a shock. The Rav, a Talmud Chacham, a Gon, and Eli got divorced. You're shocked. So he had to leave Europe. And he comes to Germany, where the atmosphere is much more open. It's like moving from Geula to, for the sake of argument, Teaneck. The atmosphere is much more open. So in Germany already, studying for a doctorate, and then the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary pulls him in. He becomes a teacher of Talmud, ultimately the head of the seminary. And he goes on to a world where he remains, I cannot say synthesized, because he always struggled. He never was fully at home in the world of scholarship, scientific Jewish scholarship, Chochmat Yisrael, Wissenschaft des Judentum, but he could never go back fully to Slabodka as much as he loved it. He loved it. And he would say time and again, to be a from Jew, you got to spend a few good years in Eastern Europe in the Litvishi Yeshiva. Then you can go to Berlin. This is why when he survives the Holocaust with miracles, he goes, he had no one to turn to, no children, no grandchildren. He goes to Switzerland, the home of one of his students, Reb Shaul Weingart, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, and he spends the rest of his life in Switzerland. And the man had endless offers to come in Aliyah. And he said, I can't come in Aliyah. What will I do? I'll go to Hebron Yeshiva. They'll laugh at me in Hebrew University. I'll go to Hebrew University. They'll laugh at me in Hebron. His funeral in 1966. You won't remember, Yitzchak, what happened? The plane landed. They took the body. The Mizrahi already arranged. They're going to bury him in Sanhedria with the Gedolei Yisrael in Sanhedria. And the Chevron of Rosh Yeshiva, Chatzka Sana, who knew him from Slabodka yet, came, he was sick, got out of a sick bed, came to the funeral, told us, Talmidim, don't let the Aron budge. And he gave the word, dig a grave in Har Menuchot in the Chelkat Rabbanim. He's a Rosh Yeshiva from Slabodka. He's not a professor from Hebrew U. And the body was there for hours till the Chelkat was ready, then they moved, instead of going to Sanhedria, they walked to Har Menuchot, and he's buried in the Chelkat HaRabbanim. All right. With that background, yeah.
They want to bury him. Dolia Shabbat, you need professors?
No, Mizrahi professors, open-minded, but among them Gedolei Yisrael, Harad Sofim, Rav Herzog is buried there, Rav Meir Berlin is buried there, others, Rav Avadya Yosef, I'm talking about, not Harad Sofim, I'm talking about Sanhedria, Rav Avadya is buried there today. It's not exactly a cemetery for second-rate people, but the Helkat Rabbanim is Mamish Gedolei Yisrael with no trace of Chokmat Yisrael, no trace. Ach, what Rav Chavkel Sana, his students, that's it. Shaila is very interesting. It's from 1946. It's evidently a Yekka who might have been his Talmud, or he knew him from Berlin. He writes to him, Yididi Habibi Ma'ashol Vaisetal. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Vav Samach Reish. Tet Yud Lamed, and he writes to him, what was going on? Evidently what's going on is as follows. I'll give you the tshuva in a second, but this is what I can recreate from the tshuva. You all know the story of the Aliyah Bet, the illegal Aliyah. Alo Aleinu, the British closed the country to Jews. So you had to get in here, and occasionally there'd be a boat going. And in the memoir literature, this always pops up. Suddenly there's room on a boat, they can sneak you in, and the boat is leaving on Shabbos. No? Are you allowed to get on the boat on Shabbos? All right, you'll see, Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim, the sources are here. That's for certain reasons. You could be allowed to sail on Shabbos. The boat is being run by Goyim. They're not doing the malacha for you. The boat is going to go with or without you. But there's a concept, if you're going to sail on Shabbos and it's permitted, let's say for the sake of Aliyah, Eretz Yisrael, so you'd be permitted. Fine. You have to be kind of shvita before Shabbat. What does that mean? You go on to the boat before Shabbos. You're makabel Shabbos on the boat. Rabbi Chil Yaakov says, halavai, you should make kiddush on the boat. And then you get off the boat, you go home, you go to sleep, and the next day you come and go on the boat, and the boat sails. All right, with Dvar Mitzvah, it probably is Mutter Meikar Hadin. It's a whole sugya in Shabbos. You're not allowed to go on a boat, Gimel Yah Yutet, right? You're not allowed to go on a boat. You see who your grandson is? Do you just saw what happened? I'm thinking, I believe it's Daf Yutet. Your grandson is shaking his head. He is the bucket. You got some grandson there, Chaim. Be proud, and buy him whatever sefer he needs. Okay? I'll pay if it's a problem.
He
would you?
He does
you,
not have room in this house for his
farm. None of us have room. Wait, don't talk to my wife. You'll get me into trouble. Okay. Baruch Hashem. Even at his age, don't ask.
Anything
is ocean alive is a ship. A ship. Thank you for that correction. Never heard that before, but if I remember, I'll say ship. Fine. So now, there was a different problem. These Jews, they weren't all from. As a matter of fact, we have to say the truth. It's not like today when you have Nefesh B'Nefesh coming in from America and Nefesh B'Nefesh coming in from France. The overwhelming majority of the Jews are from. You have plenty of Jews who are not from, and the word that Rabbi Chil Yaakov uses is the word that I grew up on, chafshiyim. Today in modern Hebrew, what word do we say? Chiloniyim. That word didn't exist when I was growing up. As a matter of fact, I can tell you in Bnei Akiva, there were some frumies, myself included, we did not like the sing, Liotam chafshi. We used to sing Liotam Segula Viyatzeinu. Got it? Am Segula is much better than Am Chafshi. But today I have to say, no one uses Chafshi in that sense. Chafshi means I'm free. Chafshi.
That's why there's a rabbi, I won't mention his name, Kugan Hills, who will never
sing Hatikva. I spoke about
that. Will never allow it in the shul. Will never allow it in any room.
I heard that in England, there are places where they sing Liotam Kodesh.
Leo, I like Am Segula better. Leo Tam School is much better than Leo Tam Kodesh.
Means free.
That's the way he uses it here. But we don't. Today we use the word chiloniyim. Chiloniyim. The Lubavitcher Rebbe would get very angry if you said.
Degel Torah, Moshe Gafni. He doesn't
want
to sing, I think, because of
Amchopshi. Say that. So let him sing Am Segula. You understand? There's nothing wrong. Tell him to sing Am Segula instead of Amchopshi. Solves the problem. Now, when are they putting the ship on Shabbos? This tshuva is so interesting. You see, when you analyze a tshuva, the halacha here is simple, but the relevant background, the milieu, you capture an era. It's Shabbos. These chafshiyim are taking their suitcases, carrying their suitcases. Everything is going on the boat on Shabbos. In addition, you have to identify, you have to write out name tags. No? So the chafshiyim will do whatever they want. This Wasser, I understand in German means water. What does tile mean? Wassertal. Interesting. It has to have a meaning. So this Wassertal, you know, the Chafshiyim look at the frum Jews, parasites. What do you do to contribute? Here this guy is one of the bosses. Maybe you should help them. Help them with the luggage. Help them write their names on the tags on Shabbos. And evidently what came up was, you know, Midiorayta, you're only chayev if you write two letters, but it has to be written with your right hand if you're a righty, with your left hand if you're a lefty. Mm-hmm. It has to be written properly the way you would really write to do a malacha. So maybe you can do it kliyacha yad. You know where the shayla comes up, halacha lemaisa, lo aleinu. How many of you have fought in wars for the state of Israel, for your homeland, Tzagan Ali Israel? The minute I crossed the border into Lebanon in 82, and there was a big article in Yediot on the Sultan Yaakov battle. If you saw that article, it was the lead article, the cover of the magazine of Friday's, the weekend magazine in Friday's Yediot Achronot. Fascinating article. Maybe one day I'll lecture on it, but not for now. And the minute you cross the border, they write your name down. Why do they write your name down? Your name with your serial number, your misparishi, your army number, for security reasons. God have mercy if you don't come back. They have to know who was in the tank, who was across the border, who was missing, who do they have to account for. And they write your name. What do you do? Yehuda, the war is on Shabbos. People are running in on Shabbos. What do you do? What do you write? Right or wrong? This is a Shaila Halacha L'Maisa. Do you write that? And you have to write. There's no two ways about it. And do you write with your left hand? What are you allowed to do? Benjamin, you're Benjamin Baruch, right? I want to get all the names. Okay, who here is not on the list? Adi Sina, who is that? He came in, he's not here. Is he in the class? Dovid, your name, and right, you're not. Michael, and pass it back to Michael afterwards. So I have, and leave a contact number, an email number. Anyway, coming back here. So he wants to be a nice guy. Look at the chafshiyim, are going to look at the datiyim. Hey, you guys, you're freeloaders. You're not helping us. Give us a hand with the luggage. Give us a hand. Write our names. They don't even know Shabbos, and they don't understand the klalim of Shabbos. And this is the tshuva, Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. And he says, I have your letter, and I'm the happiest person alive that you're going in Aliyah, and that you're involved with Pidgin Shvuyim. What Pidgin Shvuyim means, if you don't get these Jews, it's 1946, if you don't get them out of Europe, who knows what will happen to them. Ashrecha be'olam hazeh, v'tov chelkecha be'olam haba. And he writes, what you're writing about, the ship leaving, Shulchan Aruch Or HaChaim, Simen Reish Mem Chet, Sif Gimel, It's absolutely mutter under circumstances. And here where you have both mitzvah Yishev Eretz Yisrael and pidgin shvuyim, it's mutter. But you have to be kona shvita before Shabbat. And he says, halavai, you should be able to make kiddush on the boat Friday night before you go home to where you're sleeping, and then come back to the boat tomorrow morning. And then he comes to the question, what about the baggage? What about carrying it on Shabbos? There's no Erev. I don't have to tell you. When he said the Oraita, Tiltil Hotzah. So he says, Chas v'chalila, anyone should carry. You have Goyim porters. Let them help. Let them do the actual carrying. As far as the from Jews that you say, they will have their baggage on the boat before Shabbos, but it's a question of helping the Chafshiyim, who shouldn't look down upon you. He says, Chas v'chalila, there is never a concept that one Jew should do a small sin to aid another Jew for whatever the reasons may be. And then he goes into writing. He says, writing the names, helping them identify their luggage. Chas v'chalila, even if they're going to say that the from Jews are not helping us, but adarabah, let them see that you have principles. Let them see that there's a Shabbat in the world. And chas v'shalom ein ata achray bi'at hachafshiyim. For chalila l'chala zot afilo al yedei shinui. Kidei lahatzil et hachafshiyim me'alvo la'avo avera k'daka. And you see, you can make an argument. I'm a from Jew. I know that you can't write with your right hand. I'll write with my left hand. These Jews are all writing with their right hand. They're chafshiyim. Chas v'chalila, this is not a consideration. Even to do a small sin, you're not allowed to do a small sin, even if it saves another Jew from doing a bigger sin, a worse sin, a total sin, etc. And this is halacha l'maisa. And he says, you should not be concerned with the chafshiyim. You have to set an example that a frum Jew understands Shabbat, and you're willing this boli surim v'inuyim v'hefseidim rabim ubulvad shalo l'chalel et haShabbat shehi echad me'ikarei datenu. A very, very powerful statement. And he ends off, sof davar, lo lechapeis kulot, ki yim lilchom, lo becheder, velo bechanit, ki yim beruach ubeometz halev. A very powerful sentence. That we're going into the rabbinate and Binyamin, you have to be able to inculcate love, respect, understanding of Yiddishkeit, Torah, but you cannot do it by force, with a knife, with a gun. It's a tremendous challenge. I need not tell you, we have great Rabbanim, and the Chafshiyim see you, the Chiloniyim look at you. Do you influence them? How do you influence them? We suffer with this question until today. There's no black and white answer. The outreach movements have developed many approaches. You go to NCSY, you go to Chabad, you go to Aish. They have many approaches, at times very tolerant, but they take the approach better to be tolerant and to accept the fact that people are Mechalel Shabbos, Ochling, Nevelit, and Treifat, even in front of your eyes, but to try slowly but surely to raise the level. And I need not tell you, the success rate is quite quite amazing today, at least for someone like myself who grew up in a world where everyone was running away from Yiddishkeit as quickly as they could. Okay, the high point now. The high point. Yitzchak, you remember the yeshiva in our days. The Mashgiach, Rav Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessen, who left such an imprint on our characters. When he walked around, did you feel he was in New York, or did you feel he was still in Slabodka? Absolutely, absolutely. That was his charm. That was the fact he couldn't influence the masses, because most of the students couldn't relate to a Yiddish...
Yeah, he spoke about spiritual vitamins. They didn't
crack it. Right. No, most of the students couldn't relate to him. But the inner few, the chosen few, you, myself, Jerry Blau, the name later, Shimiyaita, remember he wrote Sperm Zichrono Levracha. Who else? There was a handful of us that were very close to the Mashgiach, and as you know, I have an important smicha from him. And you know why I say important, because the yeshiva gave the same klaf, the same wording, every Tom, Dick, and Harry. The guys in our class, who I'm Eretz 50 times over, they have the same smicha, and there's Reb Aaron Lichtenstein who has the same smicha. But a personal smicha from the Mashgiach, that to me is worthwhile. Chaim's father, at a later stage, was also greatly influenced by the Mashgiach. Right? You with me, Chaim? All right. Today, you come into the yeshiva, there's a big void. Dove this year, there's no Mashgiach anymore. It's the Mashpia, Reb Moshe Weinberger. Wow. Nu Yitzchak, you got to be smart, intelligent. I got a big compliment Friday night. So I was at dinner, whatever we... I spoke, others spoke, we had a good time. And someone said to me, wow, you're so different. Everyone else your age is cursing out the new world. It's horrible, it's terrible. These young rabbis are idiots. What will be tomorrow? And you're happy with all the changes. So I got to tell you, there's some people, if I would say, the mash is gone, and the mashpir is here, Reb Moshe Weinberger, Esh Kodesh, Woodmere, you know what I'm talking about. Wow, what this man did. Other people, oh my God, what's happened to Judaism? I mean, dancing, singing, Kabbalah, Hasidus, a shrine. Wow. But this is what the youngsters relate to today. Rakefit will give a shir on the Rav. All right, I Rakefit knew the Rav well. He can give a good shir. You know, if people would come to the shir in this building, you can count them on the fingers of two hands. The mash, 12 o'clock midnight, had a fabring in here that a bring in, spend a fortune on hiring chairs, hundreds, 500 buses, 3 o'clock in the morning, they're eating chullin, dancing, singing, refining shalom, Rabbi Yerucham Yerulik would have a heart attack to see this Narishkeit, in his opinion. Did you know Rabbi Yerucham? You know what I'm talking about? You heard the name. Baruch Hashem. My dear students, the Mash was once a youngster. He studied in BMT. Among his other teachers was a guy named Rakefet. And he today is an absolute class act. He's going to try to change the world now. And I want to tell you, some people, very cynical, they laugh. I don't laugh. He may be able to change the world. Give him credit. Okay? Let's see what happens. Left the yeshiva, now a koilel and Talmidim, and he's backed by his heavy money, some balabatim. Let's see what happens. But he was once young and just beginning. And he put out a volume which I highly recommend to everyone, Jewish Outreach, Halachic Perspectives by Rabbi Moshe Weinberger. Prefaced by Rabbi Ephraim Buchwald, Ketav Publishing, 1990. The book was given to me by my Talmud, Rabbi Nachum and Judy Amsel, my Talmidim. Rabbi Nachum Amsel, Rabbi Dr. Nachum Amsel, today is in Panama City, was a member of the very first group that YU sent over to satisfy Mr. Gruss. that Rakefa got the building from you, and we're going to do something in the building 1975-76. Nochem was my student right here in this building. Baruch Hashem. And very now these are problems you never dreamt about. In my time growing up, even if your home wasn't from, all the kids in Bnei Akiva, their homes were kosher. You got to understand what America was like. It's like Mesoratiyim in Israel, like the Sephardic world before Shas came on the scene. Every Sephardi is Mesorati traditional. But on Shabbos, we'll make Kiddush, turn on the television, watch the soccer game. America was like that. The kids in Bnei Akiva, many kids, their fathers worked on Shabbos. Everyone worked. It was 5.5 days work. Shabbos afternoon, you came home at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. But the homes were kosher. But outreach begins. Imagine you're outreaching to kids whose homes are not kosher. What does the kid do when he comes home? How does he eat? I mean, the problems. I taught, I won't give name. I taught a student before most of you were born. A lady. A very funny name. I found out her father was Italian, her mother was Jewish. I'm sure the home was in kosher. And NCSY picked her up. She became a tzaddiket. Her son later studied me in the kollel with payas around his ears. Second generation student. These are questions. Whoever thought of this? Whoever asked it? And Rabbi Moshe Weinberger, as far as I know, this was the first book that dealt with these questions. And beginning on page 76, I'll just give you a sampling of some of the problems here. But this concept, can you do a little sin to save people from a big sin? All right? Let's take an example that haunts every rabbi and haunted the Rav. If you read the Rakefitz, the Rav, the world of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, you're in the rabbinate now. And this is the modern world where you count, you are the center of the universe. Not the Ribbono Shel Olam. You, personal happiness. David Haduvi Hartman, a Lakewood graduate, don't give YU the blame. He came to YU a fully finished product from Chaim Berlin and Lakewood. No, Duvi in his last book, member of his congregation, comes to him, Rabbi, I'm in love with a Grushar. I'm in love with a Giyoret. I'm a Kohen. I will gladly marry you. Personal happiness more important than halacha. Bring me any Kohen who wants to marry a Grushar or a Giyoret and I will perform the wedding. Quote, end quote, in the book. Here he has the very question on page 76. He cites sources. A Kohen comes to you. Rabbi, I want to marry a divorcee. No, do a little sin. Be Masada Kedushin. It's a little sin. But at least you'll save them from living together in sin. And that's probably worse than not marrying them. And he says, absolutely not. Acquiesce in such an instance would be a falsification of halacha. Okay. I think we all agree. I don't think there's any machloket here. I think we can all agree. Right or wrong. But now let's go a step further. And here he quotes a very famous tshuva. I remember in the Michlala where there was a spirit in the 70s of Poli Agudat Yisrael. I remember Rabbi Kuperman would teach this tshuva, lecture on the tshuva. New, you know what I'm talking about? Rabbi Chilul Yaakov Weinberg, Chelik Bet of the Sridi Yeshin, the original publication. Why do I say original? It was published by Mossad Rav Kook because it was put out in a new edition by Rabbi Dr. Avram Abba Weingott, the Talmud Mufak of the Sridi Yeshin after World War II. At times the numeration is different. But I'm quoting from the original edition. I know this tshuva by heart. Perik Chelik Bet, it's tshuva Chet. Number 8. What is the tshuva? It's a fabulous tshuva. Rabbi Chiya Yaakov Weinberg after World War II. Do you know what French Jewry was like? There was no Yiddishkeit basically in France whatsoever. That's where the Rebbe lived. Remember studying studying maritime engineering, and he was active to a certain degree in the local community, and I think he got his, it's not his first taste, but he certainly learned what the Western world is all about, and how much amratzit there is, and how much irreligiosity when people don't know anything, and I think it just added to the world view of the Rebbe, that later in life, if you went in for Yechidit and you said to him, my friend is not religious, what do you mean he's not religious? He's a Jew, he's an Einikel of Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, he will be religious. Teach him, don't speak negatively. So, and these were all Ashkenazim. The change in French Jewry comes when Algeria and Morocco and Tunisia and all these countries, France gives up the war, the battle, and they have French citizenship, and they can come to live in France, and tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Sephardic Jews pour into France, and endless, endless religious commitments, some total and some Mesoratim, as we say in modern Hebrew. But before that, the Ashkenazim, France, beyond Germany, was the second most assimilated country in the world. And it could be in the 20th century, it was the most assimilated, because at least in Germany, there was a rebirth under Torum Derech Eretz, Rav Hirsch and Rav Hildesheim and their descendants, and what happens in Germany, could be France was the most assimilated country in the Western world. I'm probably right. You can underline the most. So after World War II, with the survivors, and there's a little bit more Yiddishkeit, and there's an organization in France, they organize Ezra, it was called. Not the Ezra, it's nothing to do with Ezra of Israel, which is now celebrating 100 years, I believe, since it was organized. But Ezra, like B'nai Akiva in the United States. You know how many kids became frum through B'nai Akiva? How many kids went in Aliyah? How much in B'nai Akiva? Do you know that they held the reunion about 20 years ago of North American B'nai Akiva living in Israel and their descendants? It was held in Binyanei Huma was not big enough to hold the crowd. They could never hold another reunion because you'd have to hire Yankee Stadium, and even that wouldn't be big enough. You'd have to take a stadium that could seat 250,000 children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Hara. So now in Ezra, boys and girls sang together. You're going to hold the youth group. Boys and girls are together. Boys and girls interact. I went to B'nai Akiva. Malka went to B'nai Akiva. We met in B'nai Akiva in that interview Ignite. In that interview with me, they asked me, oh, you met your wife, B'nai Akiva. Did you know you get married? That's a stupid question. A kid is 17. I mean, you met a girl in B'nai Akiva. She was my chanicha. I write in Washington how I met her. I was teaching Pirkei Avot. And she's talking to a friend. Maybe she was talking to your wife-to-be. I don't know, one of the girls. And I said, what did I just say? And she answers me, Hamalpin p'nei chaveru v'rabin mein lo chelik li'onam haba. All right, with a sharp answer like that, quoting the Gemara, I got very impressed, but I cannot say she was 15, I was 17. I cannot say we were ready to get married the next day. But Yitzchak, B'nai Akiva, this was Ezra in France. Now, following World War II, there were more from Jewish survivors in France, and these were East Europeans, and they were very upset. Boys and girls singing together, interaction like this. Wow. And they turned to Rabbi Chiya Yaakov Weinberg, who they felt knew Eastern Europe, knew where they were coming from, but knew where they were at now. He was in Switzerland. He had been in Berlin. This was Paris. Can we permit this? And here you have a brilliant tshuva that he takes the approach that we have to overlook the little sin perhaps that we're getting involved with, because this is the only way to save orthodoxy, Torah. Don't like the word orthodoxy, to serve Torah among the youth. And here in this tshuva, first of all, yes, Moshe, I know. There he says there are matirim because boys and girls are singing together. And so first of all, there may not be a sin of all. Yes, what do you want to say?
It's slightly different than the other cases. Because here it's more like the case of the Shulchan Aruch says a lot of violent job is to protect the person from, who's being kidnapped and is going to become completely assimilated.
Do not suffer from sablonitis. We will come to that. Hold off yet. But he doesn't say that in the tshuva, but I'll show you where it is said. But not yet. Let me go shlav. You should know, when you're a Rebbe, you have to be clear, and you go step by step by step. But what you said is absolutely correct, but we'll come to it. But here, first of all, the matirim. It could be treiko lo mishtoi. The Gemara says that. Two voices are not heard. So if boys and girls are singing together. All right, he doesn't go into what may have been the Rav Shita, that kol isha does not just mean a woman's voice. We hear women's voices all the time. It means a sensuous expression. When you're singing a song, licentiously, sensuously, if you, God have mercy, if you look at television today, what they show on television and sitcoms, in Israel, in America, in BBC, God have mercy, what's done in public today, what's said in public today. We walk around naked, not just in, with our bodies, but with our mouths as well. I have a dear Talmud, Dr. Norman Gold. So he feeds me sitcoms. My wife and I like halavai. I should be able every day to take off a half hour and forget the world and forget all our tzaras, forget the news here. I mean, I'm not so happy to hear about all the killings that we go through and what we did with Oslo, what we did with leaving Gush Katif. I mean, we're the stupidest people alive. They should take the people who made these decisions and put them in jail for life. They've killed so many Jews, and they laugh at us.
They don't even apologize.
They don't even apologize, and they're now celebrating Oslo. It's based, what is it, 30 years, 20 years, 25 years, I think it is. God have mercy. So you see a sitcom. All right, so there's some sitcoms you can laugh, and it's funny. There was one English one, Keeping Up, what's it called? Keeping Up Appearances. I recommend it, and know that the man who plays the husband, he's a Jewish guy from you don't see his face. I cooked ice for Gabbai in Young Israel, and he's from Germany to Britain. And he can nicht a breckel from Yiddishkeit, doesn't know a damn thing. Not like in the Fawlty Towers, the waiter is Jewish. He's a Kohen. He made a career. He just died. He made a fortune in England. He would speak when Binyamin Shul held their annual fundraising dinner. They gave the guy 5,000 sterling to come and speak. You know what I'm talking about? The waiter in Fawlty Towers. He was a Kohen. Vifrum, I don't know, but at least he knew you. This guy, in Keeping Up Appearances, he is leftist. He's demonstrated against Israel with the matzpein, with the merits, with this and that. No, you can watch it. It's an amaretz of bur. Halavai, if we can get to him, we'll turn him into Yerechei. Don't give up. But there, he gave me another sitcom. I just find a friend. We watched the first chapter. Malk and I both said we can't watch the vulgarity. You know, it's beyond words. And they say a kid over 15, I think, is allowed to watch it. I don't know. A kid over 15, I'd say a kid over 105 is not allowed to watch it.
What program are you talking about?
What
program?
I don't want to mention the name. It's a stand-up comedian. I don't even know the name yet. I know the name, but I haven't mastered it yet. But anyway, this is the world today. So Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, he writes here, this is the only way we can keep them from Yiddishkeit. If we're not going to allow this, we're going to lose them altogether. So you say that in order to do this. It was justifiable, according to Rav Weinberg, to permit Kohen activities as long as they were conducted with the highest standards of modesty and appreciation for halacha. And I can tell you what Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg didn't know is that in my time, halacha lemaisa, they say that Rabbi Yitzchak Chutna, the Chaim Berlin Rosh Yeshiva B'nai Akiva, was filled with Chaim Berlin boys. I don't know, Chaim, if your father knows that, you know that I consider your father's greatest work his piece on Rav Chutna. I think that is, I quoted when I dealt with Rav Chutna, I quoted it time and time again. Don't know if your father knows this, but they went to Rav Chutna from B'nai Akiva, the Chaim Berlin boys in B'nai Akiva, and they asked in Rebbe, there's mixed singing in B'nai Akiva, he sings mirrors together, etc. Says mutter or not, is it permissible? And Rav Chutna turned away and refused to answer. So his turning away and refusing to answer is in itself an answer. But this is the 1950s. Rav Chutna of the 70s, there may have been a different response. But here I have to tell you, Rav Weinberg tells a story which has been which halavai, one of you here will go to the school Ma'aleh, learn how to make a movie, and will do a movie around this little story that he tells. And what he tells is, I repeat it word by word, but he tells us very simple. He says, there's a great difference between Eastern Europe and Paris, Berlin, the Western world. And he says, I want to tell you a story. And he says, the story is well known. And I've given you the facts about 20, 30 years ago in this in the Monday class. What was the story? Rabbi Yisrael Salanta begins in Vilna. From Vilna he goes to Kovna. From Kovna he goes to Germany. And a lot has been written why he went to Germany. It's not for now. But he had this vision that he can change the world. So he goes to Germany, and you got to make contact. What's going on in Germany? You know, you can't come to Yerushalayim and within a year be a boss. You got to see what's going on. Who are the people who have influence? So he goes to visit Reb Azriel Hildesheimer. And he comes into the shul or the school in Berlin, Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminary, and they tell him that the head of the seminary is now giving a lecture, so you'll have to wait till the lecture is over, but you can peek in. He opens the doors in the Beis Medrash, and he's giving a lecture to tens and tens of women. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanta at first was shocked. And then he said something that is classic. If a Rav in Litta, White Russia, would give a lecture to women, they put him in Cheirim. And here in Berlin, what Rav Hildesheim is doing is to be blessed, is to be appreciated. It's a different milieu here, a different atmosphere, a different challenge. And he says, both of them are right. In Russia, White Russia, Lithuania, I can understand they'll be angry at the Rav. And here we have to bless the Rav for having such insight and ability. And Allah halacha, he paskins, as long as the boys and girls are singing together, and he knows that other poskim might very well disagree with him, but the circumstances are different here. There are authorities who can be relied upon in support of this position, and Rabbi Yechiel Weinberg absolutely permits it. And this, to a certain degree, what is he saying? Perhaps when it comes to Kiruv Recholkim, we have to do a little sin, something a little bit off the derech, off the mainstream, but to save Jews from bigger sins. And let me go one step further today. I'm going to take on next week the main... Yes, Yitzchak.
I don't understand why you said that this appears in Mayana. You're the first person quoting it. It was already in Sweden.
No, the tshuva with the boat was never seen before. It was just published from manuscript. And that tshuva, I said, wow, I can't believe it. I just opened this up a week ago. And I say, gee, this is what we're talking about. But now let me go one step further. Now let me... bring Moshe into play. The truth is, there's a much deeper level, and this comes to pass halacha l'maisa in my own life. The Chafetz Chaim already ruled, and it was well known, that you can do almost anything outside of the three averot to save a Jew from total assimilation. This is pidgin shvuyim, but not physical, spiritual. Where did the Chafetz Chaim come to play? Very simple. The communists. People risked their lives to smuggle Jews out of communist Russia. At times, it was done on Shabbos. At times, you couldn't get kosher food. And the Chafetz Chaim saw no problem halachically, tov sheyichalalu Shabbat echad, that other Jew should be able to observe many Shabbatot. This came to play in the state of Israel, and I alluded to this, now let me elaborate. When the Mossad opened the branch Nativ, you can read the history today again, a number of books have been written, Nitiv Hadmama, which basically is a fallout from the Mossad, published by Shazar, Mekhar Shazar. Rakefik writes in English in Washington. And there are more, there's memoirs of Nechemya Levonon, who was the head of the whole Mossad division here. But one branch of this division of the Mossad, Nativ, dealt with the Jews in Russia with the Shluchim, or the Shluchim, call them what you want. Aryeh Crow later gets Pras Yisrael. He was the genius who came across this idea. He was a kibbutznik, kibbutzad. But he came across that someone in kibbutzad, he met someone from England, a guy named Jackson. Could you believe it? Jackson's granddaughter later marries my brother's grandson. I couldn't believe it at the wedding who I met. I mean, he was a legendary figure, but Jackson, Ben Yaakov, was English. And Aryeh Crow knew him from kibbutz Adati. And I said, let's try sending you to Russia. You're an Englishman. You can get in. Remember, after the Six-Day War, no Israeli can get in. It's not like today that Americans can't get in, but Israelis can. Today it's just the opposite. But then, you couldn't get in whatsoever. Today an American has to apply for a visa. Then he can get in. So I.A. Crow came up with this idea, and he sent Jackson, I don't know who his partner was, maybe his wife, whatever. And this became a major operation. Now, these are people going into Russia. At that time, you don't want to be identified as a Jew. And you have missions to do. And you have to go as a tourist. Moshe, the Russian government is not letting anyone in who's not a tourist. That means you have to go and view tourist sites. You have to be part of a group. Not so simple. What do you do about Shabbos? What do you do about kosher food? So the original psak that they got, Nativ, was to save Jews, the Chafetz Chaim, go in, even if you have to ride in the metro on Shabbos, exactly that psak. Go in, even if you can't get kosher food, do the best you can. I mean, there are such, you can have hard-boiled eggs, do other things in the hotel. It's not exactly the Mahadrin. But you got to be there, you got to eat, you got to keep going, you got to teach, you have to set the tone that Yiddishkeit is still alive. And exactly the Chafetz Chaim, that was what the Mossad Nativ relied upon, halacha l'maisa, the Rav who gave the psak is the Yirei Shamayim 100%. And that's exactly what Moshe said before. when it's a question of bikuach nefesh, but the underline the word spiritual bikuach nefesh, you can do everything outside of the three main aveirot. And I'll end off on a personal note. When I got involved, when the Mossad tapped me on the shoulder, so I was very uneasy with continuing this psak. Why? Very simple. By 1980, there were many from Balei Tshuva in the Serivnik, which is the Hebrew word for the refusnik community. People know that all along they were from Jews. They were mainly Chabatnikim. The truth of the matter is, in Russia, it was very hard to find a frum Jew who was not a Chabatnik or a Chabad descendant. For instance, in the old shul, in the one only shul in Moscow, the Karl Synagogue, there was a Jew there, a fabulous Jew. He had yet studied with the Chafetz Chaim. But his own children knew nothing of Yiddishkeit, his grandchildren. Chabad, you found at times where there was a second and a third generation, even under the communists. But see, what happened with the refusnikim, had the Russians allowed every Jew out when he applied for a visa, there wouldn't have been any Balei Tshuva. What happened was a very simple process. What happened was a very simple process. Person went into refusal. He lost his job. He suffered. He was watched by the KGB. Some of them wound up in jail, Oleinu, Asiri Tzion. Well, a person has to ask himself, why am I suffering? Why is this happening? Well, when a Jew starts to ask questions, that's when the journey begins to become a Torah Jew. And these people started asking questions. And they started getting answers, and they started observing. And that's how the Mossad came to me, because they requested Gemara. Until then, no one had gone to Russia to teach Gemara. People went to Russia to give lectures on Israel, lectures on the Hebrew language, to deal with money situations. Again, I can't believe I'm telling you all this, but the security clause has been lifted. Had I spoken like this before 202, I'd be in jail. But 202, they lifted the security clause and gave Aryeh Kroll, the head of this division, Pras Yisrael. So now they requested someone to teach Gemara. Why? Because they had reached the stage where they studied Tanakh, they studied Mishnah, but the Gemara was locked to them. They needed someone to unlock it. And I had the schut that, beginning with my mission and my success, I then officially started working for the Mossad. I sent over 200 people until the Iron Curtain fell. Generally speaking, we always had two couples in Russia where the man was capable of teaching Gemara, such as Rabbi Rubin.
Who, and I taught him to a group of people in Moscow, Ikarei Amunah.
Ikarei Amunah.
Four lectures.
Kol HaKavod. And this was unbelievable, but I reached the conclusion, how can we ride on Shabbos if there's Shomer Shabbos already there? What does it look like? And from that point on, all our shluchim were never mechallel Shabbos. Shabbos, I was at in a hotel in Leningrad, way out, beautiful hotel, pre-Baltiskaya. So I told the people in Leningrad, wait until I come to make Havdalah. That's the picture, famous picture that I've published. I write about it with the Havdalah candle on the table. It's not for now, but wait for me to come. I will get on the subway 5 minutes after Shabbat is over. And they waited. And that itself is an example. As far as food goes, you had the beriyaska. I remember people from America brought me tuna fish, canned, He couldn't bring anything in with Hebrew writing, and then tuna was not yet available in Israel. It's not like today when tuna fish is cheaper in Israel than it is in America. It's a different ballpark today. I just picked up 6 cans in a wrapping in Osherad, and I was laughing at the world, less than I would spend in ShopRite to buy tuna.
Except
albacore white. No, you'll make that, so tell them to get it for you. Tell them there are enough angles in Jerusalem. Usherad should get albacore white, and we'll pay, instead of a 20 shekel for 6 or 24, I think it was, we'll pay 30 shekel for 6 cans.
It's
in the wrapper.
25 shekel a can.
Where?
Are you kidding?
What, tuna?
White
is about 20. Oh, he's talking white can. All right. So we have to be wealthy like you guys to buy it. What do you want out of it? Bring it. How much is it in America? 99. If it's 99 cents in America, they can sell 6 here for 25 shekel. Cut it out. Yeah, we must be talking different products.
You're talking about is for cats.
No. Tuna I'm talking about is star kid. What do you want for perfect tuna?
It's...
I never saw that. It doesn't matter, gentlemen. I stand on what I said. Beautiful tuna for human consumption is cheaper in Osherad than it is in the United States. Alaka kama vakama. No, I'm a businessman. When it comes to shopping, anyway, be it as it may, we brought in bread and peanut butter and jelly. And then the locals told us which bread you could buy, but it's milchiks. The Russians would put milk into the bread to be healthier, because the Russians didn't have a good diet, so the government put milk in. Very few breads were par. Very interesting. But the locals know, they told you. So we managed. But we never ate anything that wasn't lachatchila. You have to set an example. Okay, so we've set the stage for the biggest problem that all of us have and all of us suffer with, and Reb Moshe Weinberger was one of the first, if not the first, to discuss it. Can you do a small sin to save other Jews from major sins? It all goes back to announcing pages in shul, sort of a simple question. And yet the implications, as you'll see next week, are something all of us face if we're in the rabbinate, if we're in outreach, if we're just human beings and want to interact with other Jews. My dear students, next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, I'll end off this question and we'll take on a question very, very similar, but very fascinating. Again, if you're in the rabbinate, it haunts us. Can you repeat or daven in the vernacular? Shuls in America, responsive reading of Psalms, something you really don't hear about today, but Yitzchak, you had it in your rabbinate? Absolutely. I had it in mine. And something that is so indicative of the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, time has marched on, it's a little bit different. So what did we do today? We've gone further. Good luck. I wanted to talk, I'll talk with you tomorrow, Be'ezrat Hashem. We've gone further with the question of a small sin for a big sin, and we saw ramifications of it. Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg, Reb Moshe Weinberg of the Mashpia, and we have one major step to go yet. Tomorrow, Be'ezrat Hashem, I pick up exactly where I left off last week with the Rav's unbelievable hesped of Reb Chaim Isaac Rezhensky and what happens in 1941 at the next convention. And I'm going to tell you a story that you should never, ever forget. It happened in this very classroom. Freebies. Okay. First of all, this is unbelievable. It's making the rounds. Rav Kook speaks about the difference between a free man to one who is a prisoner. Natan Sharansky, before they sentence him, when they allow you in communist Russia to say a few words to the judge, speaks about the difference between a free man to a prisoner. It is amazing how similar their statements are. And remember, Natan Sharansky never ever knew who Rav Kook was back when he was being sentenced. Anyone wants, I made a number of copies. It's well worth it. This is from the rabbi who runs RCA in Israel, Rabbi Reuven Treibacher. He went to visit the two families that were murdered, Lo Aleinu, last week at the Barkhan Industrial Park. And a very fascinating report. And I read in the newspapers, where they have no axe to grind, that they greatly appreciated the visitors, not of the government officials, but of the people who really didn't know them and came to share with them. Beautiful, beautiful article. Here's a letter to the editor by Stephen Flatow. Recognize the name? His daughter was my student, but an older daughter was killed down south in a terrorist attack with a duker. I knew both families. And here he writes a letter about Oslo. It's unbelievable how stupid we can be. This is with the Beit Din in America to be Matir Agunat and Matir, all these problems. It's a review. It's Rabbi Simcha Krause's based in. And it deals with one of the cases. I can't have an opinion because I don't see the original material, but this review is more negative than positive. This is an old article from 2013, but very fascinating, about Jacob Lew, who was later Secretary of the Treasury, I believe. He was a totally frum Jew. And this is an article, "Will Republicans Let Lew Get to the Treasury?" And the article centers around his Shmirat Mitzvah and what he can do on Shabbos, what he can't do.
It was under Obama.
Excuse me?
It was under Obama.
Yeah, under Obama. Obama was not anti-Semitic. The problem with Obama was his concept of Israel was like Shimon Peres, which he would say publicly. If anyone wants to go today, remembering the Rav, in a few more hours, there'll be a beautiful event in the main academic center. Where is it? In one of the Belfer Hall, Weisberg's Cummings. I have no idea what this is. Belfer Hall, big building. In YU, I know where Belfer Hall is, but where is Weisberg's Cummings? Wilf Campus? I'm not smart enough to remember all these different names. There's a big event. The OU has completed the 5 volumes of the Rav on Chumash. I should say Rabbi Dr. Arnold Lesticker has completed God Give Him Strength. And here's from Michael, a very interesting article from the New York Times, what it's like being a Red Sox fan at Yankee Stadium. It's called Behind Enemy Lines. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vadanya. Now, who will take care of uploading? You know how to do it?
I'll give it to Simon here.
I don't know. Can you teach Binyamin? Do you know how to upload this in YU Torah? What? You don't know how.
Can I take a picture of the tshuva of Weimer?
You didn't have the Mayan. You do better.
It's quite an ending.
What?
The last game was quite an ending.
Quite an ending and quite a disappointment. What can I tell you? How do we turn these off? This goes off like this.